Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with the extraordinary musician, Dick Hamilton. Now, when I say someone's a musician, probably you think they play an instrument. Maybe you are aware that many musicians play many instruments. But Dick is extraordinary. In this show, you will not only hear the way he discovered music as an infant, really, and his compulsion, his yearning to create the sounds that he heard, and how he pursued that with his entire life, but you will also hear a cut from his solo album called Album Myself, in which he not only wrote all the songs, but played all the instruments. And I regret that I only have time to play one cut from this album. I would play it all for you because it's amazing. But you do get to hear Dick's story, which is remarkable, and at least one cut from his album. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down
is about being who you really are. That is to say that what we see, what we hear, what you demonstrate is actually who you really are, not some version of yourself that you decided was attractive, interesting, not ugly, not some version of yourself that you've concocted so that you would not be embarrassed by the real you. I'm sure you know, I'm certainly clear on the fact that so many of us, maybe most of us, are in fact pretending to be something other than we are. And why do we do that? Well, as a psychotherapist with more than 30 years of experience with this, it is my belief that early in our lives, maybe in our family of origin, maybe in our culture, maybe in school, maybe as the result of some experience with our religious organization, we get the idea that something about us is ugly, or we should be embarrassed by it, or we shouldn't be it. Or if we show people this, we're going to get teased, embarrassed, neglected, punished, and even sometimes abused. So clever and flexible as we all humans are, we figure out very soon how to pretend that this thing about us isn't there. And we're so good at it that over time we simply forget that this thing about us was ever there. Fortunately or unfortunately, however you see it, we cannot amputate parts of ourselves. We can't actually get rid of those qualities, those ways of being, the attitudes that we have. They don't go away. In my book, which is called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I call the version of ourselves that we demonstrate our cover story. Very much like a spy creates a cover story, because if the real person were known, it would be dangerous. And that's how I feel about what we create and demonstrate, that if the real us were known, we believe we would be in some kind of distress or danger. But as I said a minute ago, those qualities which we have hidden and finally forgotten don't go away. They simply go undercover. And they are there, waiting for us. And it is my belief that our lives are better when we not only have access to all of who we are, we're not using whatever energy it's taking to suppress that, but our lives are more comfortable, more satisfying, easier. And sometimes we even get back qualities which we can use, which really enhance our lives. And it is also my belief that it is never too late, certainly never too late to begin to think about, did you have to hide something? Is there something about you which you suspect, but which you hide, deny, are ashamed of, embarrassed by? If that is so, I want to tell you that the good news is it is not too late to get it back, although I really want to caution, it's not so simple as deciding, oh yes, I hid this quality and I want it back and here it is. So if you want more information about that, you can go up on my website, which is thelynshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, S-H-O-W, thelynshow.com. And up there on my website, in addition to information about this, access to my book, the opportunity to get me to come and talk to your group or organization, you will also hear all of the shows. They're all up there in podcast, including the one I'm doing right now, and all of the interviews that I've done, interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because when you listen to these people, you hear what it sounds like to be who they really are. And today's interview is not only not an exception, it's kind of the poster child, which fortunately for me, so many of my interviews are, making the point of what it sounds like when you are really who you really are. And this really who he really is Dick Hamilton. And since this is a long interview, and I really didn't want to cut very much of it, I'm going to stop talking now and introduce Dick Hamilton. Okay, I'm here with Dick Hamilton in his extraordinary house. And I'm going to just explain that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Wonderful.
Yes. And it's clear that the art to which you have given your life and made your living with is the art of music.
Right.
Okay, good. So I only ask one question.
Okay.
And it is, can you remember, can you tell me, do you know, the very first moment in your life when music called you, when you thought, oh, I like that, or I'd like to do that, or any of that?
Yeah, actually it was a lot simpler than that. It was a Sunday. I was four. And we were visiting my grandparents, my paternal grandparents. And being Sunday and visiting my grandparents, I was dressed in such a way that even if there had been something to do, I wouldn't have been able to do it.
Not to make it dirty, is that what, the,
exactly.
Is that what you mean? Right,
yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Keep that, I mean, clean. Sunday clothes are horrible when you're a kid.
That's right.
You can't do anything.
That's right.
And so we were sitting in their living room and I realized, well, there's a baby grand piano over there. And so people were talking, and I just went over and started playing the keys. And all of a sudden I realized, I recognized, I could predict what note the next one was going to be, because I could see what the order of the keys was.
You're kidding.
No. And so I started playing.
at four,
uh-huh.
you could predict what the next note was going to be.
Sure. Well,
you
I mean,
heard
once
it
you
in
see,
your head.
Yeah, once you see what the order of the keys is and how fast it's going up, oh, and that's an octave above this one. It's just, you know, it was right there. I mean, there's nothing like piano for laying out music as it is.
Yeah, but you do know that everybody doesn't do that.
No, well, everybody doesn't have a grand piano in their grandparents' living room.
I'm sorry, Dick. That's very sweet, but not really accurate. Lots of people have it. And even if they did, they wouldn't necessarily make that connection.
No, I guess probably not. It really started before that. I remember pretty well far back when I was two and less. And my parents made sure I had my own record player when I was two because I was constantly bugging them to play theirs.
Really?
Yeah, my mom found out by the time I could crawl that if she put music on, if I was tending to be getting into stuff and getting into mischief, if she put music on, I would just stop.
Wow.
And listen.
So it's, you know what they say, it's like you came in with it, right?
Yeah.
That it was...
I'm sure.
It was a connection that was always there for you.
Yeah.
And so by the time you were four and sat down at that piano...
I had all kinds of music in my head already.
Right.
I just didn't have any way to get it out yet.
That's right. So this must have been a revelation for you. I mean, oh my God, I can actually make this stuff happen.
Yeah, it was, I didn't even think, you know, at four you don't think so much in those terms. It's all of a sudden, oh, I can do this.
Yes, and I won't get dirty.
Yeah, right. And they won't bawl me out for getting my, you know, mud on my
shirt. No, right. So did anybody notice you at the piano at that time, or?
I don't remember what anybody's reaction was.
Except yours.
Except mine, because there was something I could do.
Yeah, and you were, I'm sure, completely focused on it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so after four, what's the next thing that happens?
Well, listening to records, I would hear Harry James and just say, oh, I've got to play one of those.
Really?
You know, and then I would hear Tommy Dorsey and say, oh, no, I've got to play that. And so, also, when I was five, my uncle came back from World War II from Italy, and he had an accordion with him. And so, I could play it like this if he would do the pumping. You know, I could turn sideways.
Oh, this is hilarious. What Dick is doing is showing me how he would play the keys on the accordion by... sideways,
yeah,
while,
right, exactly.
while his uncle, the big guy,
yeah.
was pushing it back and forth, right?
Because that's where it was.
That's right.
And that really got me going because all of a sudden, as opposed to a piano where you hit a note and it kind of sustains but it decays.
Right.
An accordion, as long as he kept pumping that thing, the note kept going, which sounded much more like what I was hearing on records, which were sax sections and brass sections and so on.
So, let me just make sure I get this right. You're listening to these records, but what you're drawn to is the brass in it. It's not the only thing playing in the record.
Oh, yeah. And I'm...
Not the vocal, not the piano.
I hated the vocals.
Oh, because they got in the way.
They were in the way. I couldn't hear what was really going on.
Oh, my God. Spoken like a musician.
I've learned to temper that somehow. Particularly sitting in the presence of the singer.
I was just going to say. Right. Okay, so this is so interesting to me that as a very small child, you identified what it was in those records that drew you. I mean, it wasn't just the music. It was these specific sounds, the brass.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. You're saying yeah as though it's no big deal, and you've lived with it all your life, but I think it is a big deal. Yeah. I think it's quite unusual.
I was drawn to all the sections. I also play flute. I mean, there are a number of woodwinds that I play. Mm-hmm. So it's not just exclusively that. Anything that you can sustain... that all this thing can be happening at the same time. Because eventually, the majority of my living I made as a composer-arranger.
Yeah, we're going to get there.
As a player.
Yeah,
But that was what was calling me also, was the arrangements of these instruments and what they were all doing as an ensemble.
I'm so struck by this thing of this little boy who is drawn so clearly to a specific sound. The way those notes... sustain how they play together. That's what you're saying,
sure,
right?
Yeah. And also, as they solo, that completely sucked me in. That's why I was mentioning Tommy Dorsey and Harry James and all the other great players as individuals. Just on top of all the rest of that, all of a sudden this sound comes out and I want to make that sound.
Yes.
I want to make it with all the others, and I want to make it by myself too, you know.
Wow, that's fascinating. Okay, so you're 5 years old and you already know who you are and what you're going to do, although you probably can't articulate it and nobody else knows it, right?
I never thought about it in terms of life's work.
I'm sure you didn't.
What I wanted to do.
Yeah, no, I know, I understand, yeah. I understand. So, did your parents notice this?
Oh, sure. And they managed to get, they found a secondhand piano someplace that we put in the basement. So I had one at home. And I played constantly.
Took lessons or just sat at it and played with it?
My mom gave me the opportunity to take lessons a couple times. First when I was probably late 4 or early 5. Took me down to the Cleveland Conservatory and they had this room full of kids and all they were doing was talking about music. I said, no, I have no interest in that, so I didn't do that. Later when I was 8, she had an old friend of hers who was a piano teacher who was in town. And so I tried to take a lesson with her. And she did a wonderful thing for me. I played some things that I had composed. I mean, I didn't think of it that way, but this is something that I play. And she said, is that written down? I said, no, I just played it. She said, well, you have to write it down. I said, well, I know, tomorrow I'll play it the same thing. She said, I know, but over the years, if it's not written down, if you don't write down what you're making up, it'll be gone.
God bless her.
And so she showed me all the mechanics of it, and I couldn't read it fast enough to actually play, but I could. When you're writing, it got all the time in the world. So I started actually writing down the stuff that I was improvising when I was 8.
Wait a minute. She showed you what, whole notes?
Well, all the different note values.
Quarter, half, that sort of thing?
Right, and where they are in the staff and what this key is on paper, that's all I really needed to know.
Because you could already tell if you were holding this for a half note or you were holding this for...
Oh, sure.
You could tell, but you couldn't do bars and stuff, could you?
Well, I didn't know that that was the way it was notated until she showed me.
Amazing.
But when she did, then I knew that that's...
And you understood if you were playing in three-quarter time, you were playing in 4/4?
Well, sure. I mean, your body knows that. You know where one is.
Well, I'm sorry. I don't know how to break this to you. Everybody doesn't know that.
Well, I did spend a few years as... I really wanted to give things back. We're stepping forward many decades at this point.
Well, wait. Back up. Let's do it as much as possible.
Chronologically.
Thank you.
You got it.
I knew there was a word in there.
Yeah.
So at 8, she gives you this really important information that it can and must be written down, and she shows you how.
Right.
And you know how. So you immediately begin to write down what you've written on piano.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. All right. So, but you only have one lesson with her?
No. It was a series. I wound up teaching her how to play by ear.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
How did you do that?
By telling her what I was doing and demonstrating. And so she picked up a certain amount. She wasn't really fluent, but...
Yeah, right. But you were.
Yeah. So
because by 8, you could play what you heard.
Oh, by 5, I could play anything I heard.
Oh, dear. All right. Okay, good. So now we're 8, and you're teaching the teacher. Then what happens?
Well, I got a trombone when I was 9. I got a bugle when I was 7. Of course, there are only those notes, the overtone series were the only notes that you could play.
Right.
Which is why I realized, okay, that's why you need this so you can make it longer.
Wow.
To get the notes that are in between the ones that you can just play where they are. And my arm was long enough.
This being a slide. He's showing me, right?
Sorry, I keep forgetting we're not on camera.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And so I started playing trombone at that point. I'd been messing, my dad had a couple of air horns that he had on his car, you know, the flashy chrome air horns.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you take one of those and unscrew it from the thing, you can blow in it. I had that before I had the bugle, but that's when they realized, okay, we got to
get him something to blow.
He's going to ruin his chops because it's sharp there. You know.
So they got you a bugle.
Yeah.
And then they got you a trombone.
Yeah.
And so far, no lessons.
No.
Not on trombone either.
No.
You just play what you know, what you hear.
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, so now you're 9.
Yeah.
So then what?
Well, after that, when I was 10, we moved here to Sarasota, and I was going to Sarasota Junior High. And by that time, I had a paper route, and was starting to play some jobs on piano.
Where were you playing?
Well, there were a group of guys that were in high school that had a band. And so they asked me to come to a rehearsal. And they played some tunes I hadn't heard before, but they were obvious. The chord structure was obvious. So after I heard it the first time, then I did know
of course,
it.
Right.
So I wound up playing with them all the time.
Wow.
And so I bought a trumpet, and I bought an outboard motor for my boat.
The important things.
Right.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And, so continue from there. Every time I'd get fascinated with an instrument, I'd find some way to get one.
And because you didn't need to learn how to play them. You simply played them.
Well, any brass instrument plays the same. I mean, as you're pulling a trombone slide out, you're making the tube longer. The longer it is, the lower the note. And so that's how you control it. With a trumpet or any other valve instrument, when you push a valve down, it adds a length of tubing to the tubing that was already there, and it makes it longer. So it's doing the same thing.
I see.
And so once you understand that, then you can pick up any brass instrument, and once you get used to whatever the mouthpiece size is, you won't let me jump ahead, because I thought of a perfect example.
Oh, yes, okay, jump ahead.
Okay. This would have been 1966. I was rehearsing with a man by the name of Dick Carey, who was a genius, a musical genius. He played trumpet and alto horn and piano. And we were rehearsing over at his house. He had a rehearsal every Tuesday, the Tuesday night band. And I was playing trombone. And we finished up the evening. He said, oh, by the way, he said, next Thursday morning, there's this recording session at Warner Brothers. And they hired me to play alto horn in whatever kind of band they're concocting for the soundtrack of this thing. And they asked me if I knew anybody else that played alto horn, and I said, yes. I said, oh, who? He said, you. Do you want to borrow my other horn so you can play it a couple times before Thursday morning? So I did.
So he knew.
Oh, yeah. And I wound up playing lead on the session. He decided he wanted to play second.
Wow. All right, okay, good. So now take me back. Now you're in your early teens, mm-hmm. and you're already playing gigs, right?
Oh, yeah. We're every Friday and Saturday night, we played in Sarasota in those days, in the 50s.
Yeah.
We were it. I mean, adult musicians were almost non-existent around here.
Wow.
Well, it was a very small town back then.
Did the band have a name?
The Tropic Knights. I didn't name it that. We inherited the name from the older guys who started it before we came along.
Okay, good. All right, so now, are you thinking this is a life, this is a career, or you're not still thinking that?
Well, this is what I'm doing right now. I'm still not thinking that far ahead. It was until I was really a senior in high school that it finally struck me. You've probably spoken to some other people in the arts that have a similar problem. If I was sitting in civics class or English or one of the things I was totally uninterested in, mm-hmm. I'd start to read a paragraph, I'd get to the bottom and realize I didn't read the paragraph. I'd go back to the top and read it again, and I still didn't read it.
Yeah.
Because there's music going through my head,
right.
And I keep getting distracted from whatever it is.
Right.
So I'm sitting there filling out these papers to go study electrical engineering, because I was very interested in audio and the physics of it and so on. And I thought, well, that's something I could really get into. And I'm sitting there, all of a sudden I realize, what am I doing? How am I going to sit through those classes and actually absorb anything when this stuff is still going on in here?
Amazing.
So that's when I decided, okay, well, I'll go to Florida State and major in music.
And what did your parents think of this?
Oh, fine. It was probably cheaper than I had thought of Case Tech in Cleveland, because that was one of the only technical schools I'd been familiar with.
Wow. Okay, so you enroll and you get a BA in music?
No, I went in and took the placement exams for everything but theory. They don't even give you a placement exam. Everybody has to start with theory 101, which is like for idiots.
Right.
And I passed all the requirements for all the subjects I was interested in, math, physics, chemistry, all those things, just on my tests. So I didn't get to take any of those classes. I was only taking classes I had no interest in whatsoever except for the music classes.
Oh.
So I did that for a semester and thought,
This is silly.
It's not illegal for me to leave this school.
right.
So I did, and I went on the road and continued my development from there.
At 20?
No, at
17, of course. Okay, so the rest is your career then, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me.
Well, first band I was on was Ralph Flanagan's band. He was a very strange guy, a good pianist. Rather good arranger, very strange person. People would come up and request tunes, and he'd say, sure, we'll get that. By the end of the night, he wouldn't have played any of them that he promised. And there'd be these angry guys down there. What's the matter with you? You said you were going to play, you know. So.
Is that because he didn't know them or because
no.
he was mad? He didn't like it.
He
didn't want to be danced.
I don't know why he did that. I don't know why he just said, we don't take requests or something. I mean, you can do that. Or
yeah.
that isn't in the book.
Right.
You know, or whatever.
Right.
But he seemed to enjoy angering people. So I thought, that's a very strange way to conduct music.
Yeah. Or life.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I left that, came back here, and started playing with a group that was playing on Lower Main Street. We were playing there, and somebody said, let's see if we can get a Straits Department tour of Europe. Because they were doing that then, in the late 50s. This was 1958. And turned out, no, he couldn't. They didn't know who we were. So somebody said, well, let's just go anyway. So we did.
What do you mean?
We just bought tickets and went to Europe. We went to Paris to begin with. And
on your own dime?
Right.
Right. And how many of you were there?
There were five. And we had a great time. We were in Europe for 9 months.
Oh, my God.
And we were sitting in clubs in Paris and this one, the Mars Club, which was a very famous
You were just
club.
Sitting in?
Just sitting in.
Right.
And we met a booking agent there, and he said, I've got connections with the Army and Air Force bases around booking groups into the officers' clubs. Would you guys be interested in playing those?
Uh-huh.
We said, sure. He said, okay, tell me what country you want to see.
You're kidding.
No. So I bought a motorcycle and bought a flugelhorn and, you know.
Traveling around from country to country?
Usually a month at a time. So we were in Spain and France, and we went to the World's Fair in Belgium. That was in 1958.
Wow.
And Switzerland, and, I mean, it was great.
Okay, so why did it end?
Well, I'd never driven a motorcycle before. This is another one of these things.
Yes, right.
And never ridden it on snow and ice either.
Oh.
So you get to February, and I thought, this isn't going to work anymore. This idyllic riding around on a motorcycle playing jazz.
Right. It's nice in theory.
Yeah. It's nice in the summer.
Yeah. It's nice in the summer.
So so we came back, and I was back here for a little while and got my draft notice. And they said, you got 21 days to join something or we own you.
Wow.
So I flew up to Washington. I took some horns and some arrangements, and first place I went was the Navy Band and auditioned for them, and they desperately needed somebody that could do what I did and could play piano on their jazz jobs and you know, jobs at famous people's parties and all that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they needed somebody that could write for their jazz band and for the concert band. So I spent 4 years there writing for the band, and also incidentally, which was not supposed to be legal at the time, there was a small studio downtown doing local and regional commercials.
Downtown in Washington?
Downtown in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately took over that. So my buddies and I were recording probably three times a week, doing jingles and whatever, and I was writing all this stuff. And so that was the real living for those 4 years. And also when I got to L.A., we all got out about the same time, decided we were going to L.A. When I got
we
there,
all?
There were about nine of us that got out at the same time.
All musicians.
All musicians. Mm-hmm. Who had all gotten a draft notice and
all went.
Yeah, we were doing what we had to do and then we were getting out.
Right.
And so we all arrived there with 4 years worth of demo tapes. I mean, all the kinds of things I'd written and we'd recorded and everything. And that's what got me in right away in L.A.
Wow. And we're talking 1960?
66.
Six.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was the end of the golden age anyway, because there, you know, every network had variety shows on almost every night, and every variety show had a big band on it, and as many hundreds of us as there were, you could have used half again as many.
Right. Oh, really?
Oh, we were working 12 and 14 hours every day out of one studio into the next.
Wow.
We all played, I had three TV shows. You can only handle usually three at a time, so that's the...
And now are you're talking as an arranger and a player?
No, this is as a player.
Just as a player?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you're talking about three TV shows, you're talking about recording decks.
Right, and playing on the shows.
Yeah. Oh, playing on the shows live?
Yeah. Yeah, shows like the Hollywood Palace and the Bob Hope Show and the Joey Bishop Show and the Julie Andrews Show.
Right.
These are all the shows that I played on.
Right.
And so, yeah, you show up and, you know, and there's an audience and it's really doing a
show. Oh, that's right. That's right.
You go in and, in fact, we had the audacity sometimes to send subs on, the Hollywood Palace was a two-day show, which meant it had a day of pre-records and mostly rehearsals. And we'd send subs on those rehearsals if there was a really important record date we wanted to play.
Yeah, right.
And they'd mark the parts and we'd go in and sight read on the air in front of millions of people.
Oh, my God.
Can't believe we had the audacity to do that, but, when you're playing that much and
reading
that much,
I was just going to say, it becomes what spontaneous reflex.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. And all the skills that you, and also the great luxury of whomever was arranging for any of those shows would finish the score and hand it off to a group of copyists who were absolutely the best music copyists in the world, and yeah. The way they wrote it was absolutely clear. There were no questions about anything on the page.
Yeah.
Well, all the good guys did learn all the styles mm-hmm. because when one office had a huge job, then everybody came over and everybody went to the other. I mean, that's how everybody was able to get stuff done, by having all these guys they could call on that were all capable. And so we had the great luxury of reading all of this wonderfully copied music. There's no way we could make a mistake.
If there was a mistake on it, the copyists got blamed, even if they copied directly what the arranger had written.
Oh, yeah.
Never mind, the copyists got blamed, because they needed to catch it.
Right.
And if they didn't catch it, it was their fault, right?
As a composer arranger, you're prepared for the phone to ring at 3 or 4 in the morning. Did you really mean for that to be an F sharp
right,
or
right,
such
right.
and such?
Right, right, right.
Because
right.
it looks weird. I know it's in the key signature. And,
right.
And whoever copies for you also learns the kinds of mistakes that you
make. That you might make, right.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, fine. So now you're working every minute of every day, pretty much.
That's the way it was.
That's right. And how long did that go on?
Well, I managed to keep that up for about 4 years.
Okay, so we're...
Because now the writing is getting... Now we're into the early 70s, now around 1970. The writing is getting even more than the playing.
How did that happen?
Because people liked what I wrote. If it was a commercial, it sold cars, or it sold beer. Or
So you were doing... not just recording dates and not just TV, or but you were doing jingles. You were doing the whole the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
And this is all freelance, right?
Yeah.
Right. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Well, that's the way everybody worked, though.
Right. I know, but that's, still,
yeah.
It was. it's lovely.
Oh yeah. Well, I pinched myself every once in a while.
Okay, so here we are in the early 70s, and now you're, the lion's share of your work is becoming the writing. You're still playing,
yeah.
I'm assuming.
Well, what happened was the writing did get to be so time-consuming, and there's so much of it to do. A couple guys that I knew that were writers and players who were no longer playing, which was a disappointment. I mean, a couple of guys who were great trombone players, I never got to play in a section with them because by the time I met them, they didn't have time to play anymore.
Because they were writing, too.
Because they were writing.
Wow.
And so a couple of guys told me, you're going to have to make the choice. We all made that choice. If the playing's more important, then,
play.
Butt out of the writing. And if the writing's more important, then hang it up, you know. And,
wow.
And so I eventually had to do that. And I actually wound up not playing for 17 years.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
for a boy who fell in love with the
right.
you know, with the notes at four.
It was still, I mean, for example, a good friend of mine, Charlie Loper, who's a wonderful trombone player and is still doing films and all the stuff that is still happening in L.A. We had played together. We had arrived at the same time. We played a whole bunch of TV shows and record dates together for years, and I always used him playing lead trombone on my sessions, and he would see something on paper. He would know exactly the way I would have played that. So he'd play it that way.
Right.
And, you know, and what more can you ask?
Nothing. Yeah. It's like having yourself do it.
Exactly.
Oh, it's so great.
Yeah. But what you realize is it isn't just the time you would spend playing. If you're not playing enough hours every day, your skills start to slip away.
Yeah.
And there's no way that you can pick up the phone and say, yeah, I'll make it, and then go there and not play the way they know you play. And so that was what I gleaned also from what all the guys told me. I said, they said, it's not that you couldn't ever pick up your horn and play, but when you do, you won't have that anymore. So you don't want to be heard that way. And when I finally did decide that, so if it slowed down so much that if I wanted to play, I could play, then I really, you know, took time
woodshed.
Playing and woodshedding and going to rehearsal bands. There were a couple of good rehearsal bands in town that catered a lot to guys that were not playing enough. And so a lot of good guys were at the bands. And so slowly everything came back.
People don't know how hard it is to do what you do, what it takes.
Well, yeah, they don't know. There's no reason for them to think about the fact that when you're working, particularly working independently, well, all of us as arrangers did, you've always got deadlines. You're scoring a film.
Yes, I know.
Post-production time is this.
Right.
It will be no more than that.
No.
And so,
and the recording date is set.
Oh,
and the
yeah.
musicians are going to be there.
Yeah.
And so the music had better be there.
Oh, yeah. I played on enough dates while we were playing. Courier from the copyist is bringing in the parts for the next thing. I can remember many times that I was writing for 48 hours straight.
Wow.
I would have enough time to make another cup of coffee.
Wow.
Or when I would start to get burned out. I had a great house in L.A. It actually had a room other than the living room and dining room that was big enough for a pool table. That was one of the prerequisites when we were house hunting. And so I would go in and shoot a rack of balls. That would force my mind out of wherever it had been, because you have to think about it when you're playing pool, even if you're just playing by yourself. And then that would refresh me, and I'd go back and be back at it.
Okay, so how long did you do that?
I never have quit writing. I mean, I'm still writing for fun now. I just dug out some charts that I'd written for a group that I was playing jazz festivals with every weekend. They're three horn charts, trumpet, trombone, and tenor mostly. And so every Tuesday, we've been getting together here in a room with six of us and reading down the charts. You know, I'm about ready to start writing some more. We don't have them, everybody doesn't have them all down yet, so I've still got some leeway.
Some leeway. Are you going to perform it, or are you just
probably.
Doing it?
Yeah. We're just taking it a thing at a time. I mean, my whole thing was, in L.A., I was still playing, and I was playing a lot of trombone, but primarily on rehearsal bands. And I wasn't getting out playing jazz on trombone enough. And I was starting to feel some of that slip away.
Yeah.
I was playing more jazz on trumpet than I was on trombone.
God, this is so interesting to me. So you have to keep your chops up in every genre on every instrument.
Really. And it isn't physical chops. I mean, that's obvious. You have to have the physical chops going, the muscles and non-swelling and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But the mental part of it, that was what took the longest to come back after the 17 years I didn't play.
Meaning
the reflexes, like I'd be playing and I'd be improvising, except I was behind. My mind wasn't, it wasn't already there, however many bars ahead.
Ahead it needed to be.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When you're reading that many bars ahead.
If
you read properly.
You know what's coming.
Oh yeah, you've already heard it.
Right.
And that's the other secret too. In reading properly, you look at the phrase, you hear the phrase in your head. You're still playing what's in your head.
Yeah.
You're never playing just what's off the paper, but what you play is always coming. Is what you're hearing. You play what you hear, and what you're hearing can have gotten there from three ways. One, you're making it up.
Right.
Two, you heard it before.
Right.
Three, you're looking at it on paper. But it does exactly the same thing. I'm looking at it on paper. I'm hearing it in my head as if I was making it up. So a really good player, you can never tell if they're reading or improvising or what they're doing by the way they play.
No.
By what they play, maybe. But the way they play, it's always the same process. They're always playing what's in their head, what they're hearing.
Amazing. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that.
There aren't. The only people that I know for sure know it are people like in my position who are professionals.
Right.
And I would never have had to really think about it, except that I started doing a lot of singing in vocal groups, and because I wrote more vocal stuff than anybody in L.A.
So what do you mean you? So as a singer?
As a singer, that's the only way you can. You have to look at it and hear it in your head. If you don't hear it in your head,
how are you going to sing it? Right.
I realized, well, that's why I can do that, because I hear it in my head when I'm playing. And almost all the singers that I used were all instrumentalists. Oftentimes before they sang. Like me.
Right.
I mean, sometimes I would get hired. I remember my friend Ron Hicklin, who was the biggest vocal contractor in L.A., telling me that I was his designated hearer. He usually put me in the second tenors. And it wasn't like you were going to hear my voice, but if we were doing something really difficult or atonal or whatever it was,
you would know what to do, right.
And the guys around me would hear me do it, and then they'd have it.
Right.
Right.
And all of this, it seems to me, goes back to that thing on the piano.
Sure.
That you knew what was coming.
You can predict what it is. You know how it, what it is and how it got there.
Right. You can anticipate.
Right. And by the same token, whatever instrument I play, it's still that same process.
Yes, clearly.
I had to learn the mechanical properties of the instrument.
Yes, you had to figure out how your fingers were going to do it, but your mind already knew.
Oh, yeah, and as soon as you got the mechanics down, then it's just like you were playing anything else.
That's right. It's just like you were playing anything else, or singing.
Yeah, all right, or singing. That goes to one of the other things that I did in L.A. I mm-hmm. got a call from a guy named Pat Hicks, who had founded and ran a school called Musicians Institute in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And he said, we want to start a vocal department. Will you come and teach? And I thought, well, I'd always wanted to give back. When I got there, it was really a couple of guys, Milt Bernhardt and Frank Rossellino, were the guys that got me into the studios immediately, because the business was so heavy that everybody was booking dates back to back. And as soon as a date would go into overtime, the answering service, which is where all the messages would go through, would just come to life and start calling people saying, get over to RCA and start the next date until Milt can get there, because he's tied up in overtime.
Right.
You know, or go to NBC or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Or go finish Milt's date so he can get to this one. So all of a sudden, I was working for everybody. And that's the way quite a few of us got in. I mean, some people think that it's a dog-eat-dog kind of thing, and it's just the opposite. It was the other guys that play your instrument that bring you in. Because they need more guys.
Because they needed more guys.
Yeah.
That's probably not so true today. Because
a
lot of the industry...
Work.
Right, there's not that much work, right.
The time that I met everybody was in the middle 60s into the 70s when I was playing on everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then I met all the other guys
who were playing on everything. Right,
but after that, when I was so busy I wasn't playing, I had my own recording studio. And I'd be sitting there writing everything out, handing it to Don, who was the copyist who did all my work. And everybody would come in and we'd record it and I'd mix it and send it out and do the next thing.
Yeah, right.
So the only people I met were the guys I always used.
Who were sitting in your, sitting in the studio.
Yeah.
Okay, so what did you teach in the vocal?
I taught all of the musicianship stuff. How to read, how to write, how to recognize chords, how to sing in a group.
Wow.
And it was a lot of fun. It was very rewarding because it really did work. But if I hadn't had to think about all that stuff when I started singing in a group, because I started out hating vocals.
Yes, right.
And it wasn't until I started hearing, like, the Four Freshmen was the beginning.
Uh-huh.
I had to say, okay, that could be a section just like a trombone section.
I was just going to say, it's just like the instruments.
Yeah, and so all of a sudden I was hooked in ensemble singing.
But what you didn't get hooked in was lyrics.
Oh, no, I wrote all the lyrics for all the stuff I did.
You did?
Yeah. It's so much easier than trying to explain to a lyricist who's not a musician why that doesn't work.
Oh,
well, it's the same number of syllables. Yeah, it is, but the accent's on a different one.
Yeah.
It's spending late nights. I'm trying to finish this vocal chart, and the lyric won't work, and
I'm trying to get
this guy to come up with something that will. I wrote myself a little note one time and put it up on a sticker over my desk, and it said, "What rhymes with groin?"
Did you come up with it?
Well, there are plenty of them.
Right.
Why would I want to
do that? Right. Exactly right. Okay, so now, if you can do it with music, you're doing it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're here in Sarasota, so you must have left L.A.
Yeah.
So what happened?
Well, the fact was there was much less recording going on because so many people are using computer instruments and synthesizers and all
that. And after the Musicians Union, so much of that moved out of town.
Well, the union was ridiculous the last time. I mean, the last strike they had was in 1980. And guys that I know are going to London to record if they want instruments, or they're calling a guy with a synthesizer and finding out that can be done too.
That's right. Okay, so it's drying up
reasons. Right. And we're still doing things like the Dick Carey Tuesday Night Band that I mentioned
mm-hmm.
way back when.
Right.
Dick had died 19 years ago. It was almost 20 years ago now. But everybody in the band wanted to continue playing his stuff. So everybody looked at me and said, okay, you play all the instruments he played, you have to run the band.
Of course.
So we've still been rehearsing every Tuesday night in my studio,
mm-hmm.
and we recorded 3 CDs of his work.
Wow.
And
Before I forget, I'm hoping you're going to give me CDs or something of yours that
Sure.
Good.
Absolutely.
Good. Okay, good.
So anyway, I was doing that, and I was playing a lot of jazz, but that required me to do it on trumpet. because that's what I wound up. As soon as Dick died, I stopped playing trombone in the band and was playing trumpet and alto horn and piano. So anyway, that was going on. I was playing in Mike Barone's band, which was a great band. Mike wrote all the stuff for The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started playing with him in 66 also, just for fun. You know, we'd finish the last thing and go racing out to Dante's to play with Mike's band, or and then later Carmelo's. Mm-hmm. Those were all the places we played while they were there. Mm-hmm. Bill Holman's band. Bill is still, you know, in his late 80s, is still mm-hmm. writing and doing everything and rehearsing. And Chuck Flores, who is still flourishing, is a great drummer. And you've been running an octet lately. I was running a lot of stuff for his octet, too.
Wow.
If I can figure out how to get five horns in here, we'll rehearse some of the octet stuff. But anyway, that was all happening, but I wasn't going out and playing jazz on trombone. Mm. And the band that I was playing jazz festivals with, we were flying off almost every weekend and playing a jazz festival someplace, and basically I was playing trumpet in that.
My goodness.
Because that's what they needed. But I was starting to lose some of the reflexes on trombone for playing jazz. My ensemble playing was still fine, but I could just feel it, and Jan knew that it was, that was a sad thing, because that was really my primary, you know, but I did almost all my recording work early on trombone. I didn't tell anybody in L.A. that I played anything other than trombone when I got there. And just something told me to do that, and it was really the right thing to do, because everybody, there were no brass doublers at all. Or if people doubled, they didn't let anybody know it.
Really? Why?
I don't know. It's just the way it was. All the woodwind players were expected to play all the flutes and all the clarinets and all the saxes, and now even the double reeds. But a brass player was, if you're a trombone player, you play trombone.
You're a purist.
That's it, yeah. And if you're not, we're going to hire somebody who is. And so it wasn't until things really slowed down and didn't make any difference anymore that I let everybody know that I played a bunch of stuff.
Wow. Okay, so...
So anyway, I started coming over here because my friends Jim and Susie had retired. My friends Tony and Ann Swain were still in town. We used to play together all the time when I was at school. And so it was great. I'd come for a couple weeks at a time. And the last time was last May, and Jan came with me, and she saw all this stuff that she knew I was dying to do and wasn't happening in L.A. And just from a fun jazz playing standpoint, you know.
Yeah.
And there wasn't enough of the business left to make that much difference in the decision. Besides, we're 75.
Yeah.
So we're retired, meaning we don't do stuff we don't want to
do anymore. Very nice. Very, very nice.
Yeah. And so that's why she said, we got to buy a house here. So we came out the next 2 days and did.
Amazing. I asked this other question, but I'll ask it and
sure.
We'll see if you have something to say that you haven't already said, because I think you've been speaking to it. I ask, having given a life, and my God, you have given a life since you were two, mm-hmm. to this love of music and everything that music can do, is there anything that you would say about what that's been like, what it's like to have given a life to music?
Fulfilling.
Well, that's a...
that doesn't take up a lot of airtime.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. So maybe you could extrapolate a little bit on fulfilling.
One thing I used to tell my students at Musicians Institute was, you know, examine whether you really want to do this or not. Because you have to have blinders on if you're going to be a musician. You just have to... You have to ignore the rest of your life in many, many circumstances to be able to do it, because nobody that's not that driven, and I'm not even saying having self-discipline, because that's something you're controlling. What I'm talking about, you don't control. Something is driving you. And if something's not driving you, you're probably not going to make it, because you'll take the comfortable position sometimes, as opposed to, I can't live another day if I don't hear this.
Wow.
And so...
Yes.
You know, that's...
There's no choice.
No.
No, the choice has been made for you somehow.
Right, mm-hmm. However it works out. And, I mean, that's why writing and recording was so wonderful, because I'll hear a full orchestral score in my head, and that's great, and I love it. And I can sit down any place and listen to stuff. I don't have to turn on, you know, a machine to do it. But if it's something new that just struck me, I'll hear exactly what it's going to sound like, but that's not the same as actually having it played. I'm recording it so that I can hear it back anytime I want to. And so from the aspect of standing up in front of a bunch of people who are friendly and, I mean, in the real terms that I feel are friends, and playing something, I have no idea where it's coming from, but whatever pops into my head playing it, and getting a reaction that's positive, you know, once you've done that, you can't quit doing it.
That's a great place to stop. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dick.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
Once you've done that, you can't quit doing it. And of course, Dick started doing that. He started hearing it at 2. He started doing it at 4. And you can hear that he could not stop doing it. It was a compulsion. He was compelled. It was completely and solely who he was. And he knew it from the very beginning. And he never second-guessed it. He never wondered about it. He never wandered from it, except for that one moment when he thought he might study something else in college, and then he realized how could he possibly do that when the music was playing in his head all the time. So, from the point of view of knowing who you are and being all that you are, Dick Hamilton makes that point in the way that, although many of the people, most of the people I interview do, Dick makes it in a way that few people can. The complete identification with the thing that he is and the following of it without question. Because he couldn't question it. So, is this how it feels to you in your life? Like you are compelled to do what you do, like there's nothing else that you could do because it would mean not doing this, whatever it is. And I'm not only thinking here about a career or a skill or an art. I'm talking about the way you actually are in the world. Are you yourself in the way that Dick is a musician? Are you the person that you really are without question, without second guessing, without wondering how this is going to go down with somebody else, what somebody else is going to think about it, what consequence may come from it, what others may do in response to it? Well, it is my hope for each and every one of you that you are in your life what Dick is in his. And unfortunately, we're running out of time, and Dick did, in fact, give me an album, and we're going to go out on a cut from that album. I can't play all of it because I don't have enough time, but we're going out on Rainy Night, which is just gorgeous, and on which he is playing the trumpet with the Harmon mute lead, background section of alto horn, alto flugelhorn, 3 trombones, and solos with alto horn and alto flugelhorn, and of course all of the rhythm section instruments. So, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that you didn't know, something that triggered an important thought or memory or inspiration for you, or maybe it's just the pleasure you're going to get from hearing the cut from Dick's album that I'm going to play as we go out of the show. But whatever it is, I hope that it is something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too. Thank you.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So